Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unprecedented amateurism at the White House, which allowed the reality TV star Omarosa, the executive branch's most highly paid staffer, to record her firing by Chief of Staff Kelly inside the most top-secret and secure room in the country, the White House Situation Room. In what a former National Security Council spokesman calls the most serious breach of protocol he'd ever heard of, not only did Omarosa's recording of Kelly end up airing on Meet the Press, her subsequent recording of her phone conversation with the president, in which Trump pretends to be surprised by her firing, has also been aired widely on the media. Chris Whipple, the author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, joins us to discuss the historical perspective of the 18 former chiefs of staff he has interviewed. Their experience and professionalism makes it clear that the current White House is more than an anomaly, but rather it is a ship of fools without a rudder and a qualified captain at the helm, not to mention an experienced first mate, in this case, General Kelly, who, like his sidekick, Stephen Miller, is an ideologue dealing with real-world problems that do not lend themselves to rigid right-wing dogma. Then we'll look into the firing of Peter Strzok, the latest senior FBI official after Comey and Andrew McCabe, who Trump has campaigned against with Twitter abuse and wild charges. A former special agent with the FBI, Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, joins us to discuss whether making a sacrificial lamb out of Strzok will placate the Tea Partiers in Congress, who appear to be determined to find a way to impeach Rod Rosenstein to try and shut down the Mueller investigation. Then finally, Andrew Gumbel, the author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, Why U.S. Elections Remain Dangerously Vulnerable to Cyber Attacks. With Attorney General Sessions shifting the DOJ's focus from making it easier to vote to using the bogus excuse of voter fraud to make it harder for Democrats to vote, we'll examine why Trump and the Republicans are not doing anything meaningful to protect the nation's electoral system the Russians attacked in 2016 and are poised to do so again in November. And joining us now is Chris Whipple, who is a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth behind-the-scenes look at the men who have been the president's closest advisors, from interviews with all 17 living chiefs and two former presidents, whose members have included Rahm Emanuel, Dick Cheney, Leon Panetta, and Donald Rumsfeld. A multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes and at ABC News' Primetime, Chris Whipple is a writer and executive producer of The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Whipple.
Ian, thanks. Good to be here. Can I just add that it's now 18 living White House chiefs of staff because I've done a new chapter in the paperback version of The Gatekeepers, which is on sale now.
Excellent. And the two new people?
Well, they're 18 now if you include Reince Priebus and John Kelly. And I interviewed Reince Priebus extensively for the new chapter in the paperback about the Trump White House.
Well, it'd be interesting if you could interview Kelly, because why did he fire Omarosa in the Situation Room, the SCIF, instead of in his rather large office?
Well, it's not the usual way, is it? And there's a lot that's unusual in this White House. I suspect that it's a pretty pedestrian reason. I think that Kelly was probably just looking for a private place to do it. The White House Chief's Office has got a lot of people coming and going. You know, what obviously backfired on him was he had no idea that presumably that Omarosa was recording him. This is an unconventional White House, to say the least.
Well, it is extraordinary that Omarosa was the highest paid staffer. I mean, and the president admitted, now of course he's trashing her and calling her a lowlife and all kinds of horrible names, but earlier he admitted that the reason he kept her around, and obviously he was probably responsible for her being so well paid, was that she said nice things about him. So is that the main qualification?
That's the principal qualification for a lot of people in Donald Trump's orbit. And, of course, as we all know, everyone within that orbit is ultimately tarnished or destroyed, or virtually everyone. I can think of a couple of exceptions. But what's surprising to me is not that John Kelly fired Omarosa. What surprises me is how long it took him. You know, he didn't hesitate to throw Anthony Scaramucci over the White House fence on his first week. He ultimately got rid of Steve Bannon, and Sebastian Gorka. I think that everybody at the highest levels of the Trump White House was hoping, reportedly, that that Omarosa would flunk her FBI background check, and that didn't happen. But it surprises me a little that it took Kelly this long, because she's, you know, even in a White House with plenty of unqualified people, she really was in a league of her own and nothing but trouble. So I'm not shocked by this.
Well, it's still shocking that the most secure facility in the country, the Situation Room, which is a SCIF, you know, Sensitive Compartmentalized Information Facility, that somebody recorded the White House Chief of Staff. And then what's extraordinary is that she's had a subsequent phone conversation with President Trump that she also recorded, and that's been played. And, of course, Kelly's firing of her was played on Meet the Press, and subsequently all over the media you can hear the conversation that she had with President Trump, who denies that he had anything to do with her firing.
The honor system in the Trump White House is less than effective. And it's always been just an honor system with the Situation Room. It's not illegal technically, but it's beyond the pale. I mean, nobody ever thought anyone would do this. But I have to say that I think that this whole Omarosa-Donald Trump feud is a rabbit hole that Donald Trump would happily watch us crawl into, because, you know, in any credibility contest with anyone on the face of the earth, Donald Trump loses. But with Omarosa in a credibility contest, it's possible that she does. And I think that while this distraction is playing out and while we're all spending so much time talking about it, far more consequential things are happening in this Trump White House. And to give you one example of something we're not talking about anymore, I find much more troubling the fact that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin went into a room without a note taker, like a couple of mob bosses at a Brooklyn social club thumbing their noses at the feds, and we still have no idea what they talked about. And is there an audio recording of that meeting? One former CIA director told me that if it had happened on his watch, he would have made damn sure he had a recording.
Well, we can assume that Putin's side recorded it, right?
Well, it's a pretty good bet that they've got a recording. I wonder if we do. And the fact is, what little we know about that meeting was beyond the pale. I mean, the notion that Donald Trump thought it was a terrific idea to hand over the former ambassador to the Russians for questioning by them just makes you wonder what else they talked about and what other agreements did they make in private, behind closed doors. Never happened before. And especially under these circumstances, it ought to be really troubling to people, much more than anything Omarosa ever recorded.
And again, I'm speaking with Chris Whipple, who's a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth, behind-the-scenes look at the men who have been the president's closest advisors, from interviews with all 18 living chiefs and two former presidents, whose members have included Rahm Emanuel, Dick Cheney, Leon Panetta, Donald Rumsfeld, and Reince Priebus. A multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes and ABC News' Primetime. Chris Whipple is a writer and executive producer of The Spymasters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. And The Gatekeepers is now out in paperback in an updated version. One of the things that I think is really quite disturbing about the secret meeting that took place. And you have to admit that after that meeting, as the two leaders walked in for the press conference, there was a kind of smirk on Putin's face as he sort of swaggered in. One of the things that has just been happening on Russian television, as you probably know, Chris, on the Russians refer to Trump as our president. But on their 60 Minutes program over the last weekend, one of their top commentators, a so-called expert on the United States, more or less said that we hold stuff over him and that if Trump doesn't start delivering, we're going to have to punish Trump and we're not going to help him in the upcoming midterm elections as we did in 2016. So it's not inconceivable that in that secret meeting in Helsinki, what Trump and Putin talked about was the extent to which the Russians could save Trump from impeachment by interfering with the November elections and making the Democratic blue wave disappear.
Well, who knows? That's the important point here, is that we just don't know. And the notion that somebody like Donald Trump, who is under investigation for possible collusion or conspiracy with the Russians, would go into a meeting for 2 hours without a note taker begs the question, what was he trying to hide? So, you know, I know, having talked to all the other living White House chiefs of staff, that nobody finds this acceptable. Ken Duberstein likes to tell the story, Ronald Reagan's final chief of staff, last chief, likes to tell the story about how Reagan would occasionally go with Gorbachev into the little study off the Oval Office, just with their interpreters, to give Gorbachev a gift. In one case, he gave him a baseball autographed by Joe DiMaggio and said, hey, let's play ball. Well, that's Reagan. But it was never for more than a ceremonial thing like that. And then they would get to work with note takers. We've never seen anything like this secret meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin.
Well, the subsequent phone conversation, though, that Omarosa had with Donald Trump after she'd recorded her firing by General Kelly in the White House Situation Room, what I find extraordinary about the phone call, which again has been played all over the media, is that Trump starts the phone conversation by saying, Omarosa, what's going on? I just saw in the news you're thinking about leaving. What happened? Then she says, I just got fired by General Kelly. And he said, no, nobody even told me about it. You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know. I didn't know it. Damn it. I don't love you leaving at all. Well, that's got to be yet, you know, he's up to, what, over 4,200 lies. But that strikes me as just absolutely lying through his teeth.
Well, either that or and that's certainly very likely, but either that or Kelly, you know, he was technically he might have been technically telling the truth if Kelly pulled the trigger that day without telling him about the timing. But again, as I say, the fate of Omarosa versus Donald Trump is so much less important than all the other issues that surround this presidency, including the fact that it really is enthralled to hard right ideologues who have no idea how to govern. And I include among those people John Kelly. You know, look at what he and Stephen Miller tried to do with at the border. It's just a complete fiasco. And part of it is just the staggering incompetence of the people who are trying to govern here, including Trump, most of all.
So how do the former White House Chiefs of Staff see Kelly? Because I think it's pretty clear that he is manifestly incompetent, as are most of them. And he's obviously an ideologue.
For all of them.
Yeah.
You know, Kelly's reached out to very few of them, which is a troubling thing because he doesn't seem to appreciate precedent, doesn't seem to want to learn very much. I know he talked to Leon Panetta, with whom he previously worked, but he hasn't reached out to many others. I'll tell you, my take on Kelly, among other things, is that he suffers from what I would call Don Regan syndrome. Now, Don Regan was Ronald Reagan's second ill-fated White House chief of staff. He was arrogant, he was imperial, he was aloof, and he was politically inept. And it was no coincidence, in my view, that the Iran-Contra scandal happened on his watch. It never would have happened under his predecessor Jim Baker, in my opinion. And I think Kelly shares some of those characteristics that Don Regan had. He, you know, he's imperious and he's aloof and he is politically inept. And, you know, when he stepped up to the podium in the White House briefing room way back when and launched into that tirade against Representative Wilson, it gave you an idea of just how clueless he is politically. So I think that while John Kelly has made the trains run on time in the West Wing to some extent, he's made the West Wing more efficient. I think he's failed in every other way. And let me just mention the two most important things. One is to tell the president what he does not want to hear. That's what Jim Baker and Leon Panetta were able to do with their presidents. And the other is, another important thing is helping the president understand the difference between campaigning and governing. When you campaign, you divide and you demonize and you disrupt. When you're governing, you have to make deals with your opponents. You have to make compromises. You have to reach beyond your hardcore base. Trump has no idea how to do that, and Kelly has reinforced all of his worst partisan instincts, in my view.
And you mentioned Don Regan under President Reagan, and of course Nancy Reagan, I think, was finally got rid of him. But he came out of business, didn't he? And I noticed that
he was a co-chairman of Merrill Lynch.
That's right.
Before he became Treasury Secretary under Reagan, and it's fascinating to me because James Baker, who was the quintessential White House chief under Reagan, has a kind of unwritten rule that he told me about, and that is that people who have been principals, who have been CEOs or governors or who have exercised great power, tend to be a bad choice as White House chief of staff because the most important word in the title is staff, not chief. Nancy Reagan famously said, long after Reagan was fired, that he loved the chief part of the title. He didn't like the staff part so much.
But Jared Kushner, though, last year told the Washington Post that the government should be run like a great American company. So,
well, that's just the problem with this White House. It's been run like the 26th floor of Trump Tower. So Kushner, respectfully, I think he's a smart guy, but I think In that sense, he's dead wrong. You cannot run the White House the way you run Trump Tower. Jerry Ford tried to do that. He called it the spokes of the wheel, where he had nobody empowered as first among equals. As a White House chief, he had a bunch of people reporting directly. It's a formula for failure every time.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, back to Omarosa's book, Unhinged, An Insider's Account of the Trump White House. It's pretty damning, essentially. She says that Trump, not only is he a racist, he's also has dementia. I mean, that's, you know, and I suppose the fact that they're trashing her and calling her all kinds of names is an attempt to discredit her, not that she has much credibility to begin with. But, I mean, that's pretty explosive charges, isn't it?
Well, yes, and to anybody who for whom that rings true, it won't be surprising. But I don't think that Omarosa is the best messenger in this regard, and I think that she obviously then that begs the question of why she served this president for as long as she did, and she's known him for something like 15 years, and suddenly this was a revelation to her. So she's got real credibility problems, and as I say, you know, she may be the only person on one of the few people on the face of the earth who would lose a credibility contest with Donald Trump, if that's possible.
And meanwhile, of course, the chief of staff, John Kelly, his job has been extended, right? So he's
well,
got
that's what we're led to believe, but I don't think it means much. I wouldn't take that to the bank if I were Kelly. I think that announcement that he would stay on for 2 years was simply a way, an attempt to make all the stories about Kelly go away, because we all know that Trump could wake up tomorrow and send out a tweet firing Kelly, and no one would be surprised, would we?
Indeed. Chris Whipple, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Chris Whipple, who's a writer, documentary filmmaker, and journalist. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, the first in-depth behind-the-scenes look at the men who have been the president's closest advisors, from interviews with all 18 living chiefs of staff and two former presidents. His members have included Rahm Emanuel, Dick Cheney, Leon Panetta, Donald Rumsfeld, and Reince Priebus, a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at CBS's 60 Minutes and ABC's Primetime. Chris Whipple is the writer and executive producer of The Spymasters, CIA in the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. And The Gatekeepers is now out in paperback in an updated version. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the firing of FBI agent Peter Strzok.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice, Liberty, and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office. And as a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, he served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael German.
Thanks for having me.
And it does seem that the FBI agent fired today, Peter Strzok, is very much a sort of sacrificial lamb. Is it the case where the FBI Deputy Director, David Bowditch, who fired him, even though the director of the FBI apparently normally handles this, and apparently he thought he was going to get a demotion and a 60-day suspension. So do you know what happened there? Is there some sort of difference between the director Ray's attitude or intentions and the deputy director? I mean, I can't imagine the deputy director overruled the director.
So the disciplinary system in the FBI is notorious for being inconsistent in its application. And in this case, you know, there were obviously serious issues with the actions Peter Strzok took with regard to using a government phone to have inappropriate texts with a fellow FBI employee. But the office that does internal investigations, the Office of Professional Responsibility, apparently, according to the reporting, had done an investigation and recommended a 60-day suspension and demotion. Christopher Wray, the director, had previously stated that he would let the investigation take the normal course. So the normal course would be that recommendation goes up to the deputy director, who rubber stamps it and sends the discipline out, where here not only was the OPR decision overruled by the deputy director, and I'm not clear that there has been a public explanation for why that was, but the penalty was increased, where normally where there's some sort of mitigation, an intervention by higher headquarters, it's to mitigate a punishment rather than to increase it. and to increase it to a firing is, I think, a little more extraordinary, but not unusual. Again, this is a disciplinary process that is highly arbitrary and tends to punish people who go against what the Bureau wants at the time. So whistleblowers, people who are reporting internal misconduct, tend to be treated more harshly than favored individuals who overstep some rules in accomplishing a task the Bureau wants accomplished.
Well, it sounds like Peter Strzok was a very valuable agent, a 22-year-old veteran who investigated Russian espionage in the U.S., selling secrets to China, etc. And he already had been demoted or relegated to a job with FBI's human resources, which, of course, is not the best use of his talent. So how do you see it as a veteran of the FBI, Michael German?
Well, there's a big divide between agents and management. And so, you know, managers take credit for the work that agents do. Obviously he was a well-regarded manager who promoted quickly through the system. But that's often not necessarily based on merit, but on the personal preferences of the people working in the system, which is another complaint about the FBI's management program. Clearly, reading through the text, it's astonishing to me that somebody who is a career intelligence officer wouldn't realize that these text messages were a permanent record that would be accessed by others. So the very poor decision-making was involved here, particularly to talk about highly sensitive cases. So it's certainly clear that his behavior was inexplicable and for the average agent may have resulted in a termination. So I'm not so sad that some punishment has come, but by overruling OPR, it has inserted politics into this decision in a way that I think is damaging, particularly for anyone who hoped that the politics of this investigation would be reduced rather than increased.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office. And he's a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the FBI, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Well, when you mentioned that it's not likely to have dampened down this political firestorm, which is being largely inflamed by both the president and by the Tea Party or Freedom Caucus people in the Congress who want to impeach Rod Rosenstein, the president himself has tweeted out today, Agent Peter Strzok was just fired from the FBI finally. A list of bad players in the FBI and DOJ get longer and longer, based on the fact that Strzok was in charge of the witch hunt. Will it be dropped? It's a total hoax. No collusion, no obstruction. I just fight back. And then minutes later, he said, just fired. Agent Strzok, formerly of the FBI, was in charge of the crooked Hillary Clinton sham investigation. It was a total fraud on the American public and should be properly redone. So it sounds like Trump is escalating his battle, suggesting there's even more people inside the FBI that he wants to get rid of, along with reopening the case against Hillary Clinton. So it doesn't seem like if the intention of the FBI was to make Peter Strzok a sacrificial lamb to calm down the Congress and the White House, at least in terms of the White House, is not working.
Right. This decision seems to increase the politicization rather than decrease it. Again, not following the regular protocols and the recommendations of the professionals who do this work day in and day out seems to indicate that some other interest had an influence on the decision to fire him, which can never be good. And, to the extent, I don't think President Trump or the members of the Freedom Caucus necessarily rely on the facts in making their arguments about the Russia investigation, but certainly this is going to be more fodder for them and more seriously undermine the public perception that the FBI is operating in a normal and predictable fashion.
Well, but he's the third, Strzok. He was deputy director at the FBI of counterintelligence. You've also had the FBI's deputy director, Andrew McCabe, forced out in a rather petty way. They fired him the day before his pension was due, and, of course, James Comey. So it seems to me that the more President Trump and the Freedom Caucus can point to FBI senior officials being fired, the more it gives credence to the idea there's something wrong. Is that their strategy? Because from the outset, this seems to me to be an outrage because, you know, they've demonized the FBI and the DOJ, and it seems to be all a part of a public relations effort to essentially mitigate whatever it is that the special counsel comes up with. In other words, it seems to me that the FBI is being scapegoated here for what appears to be the crimes of our president.
Right. And you know, I think this is a discussion that needs nuance, which unfortunately is very rare in today's political discourse. Clearly, the misconduct that Peter Strzok was involved in, that Andrew McCabe was involved in, and that James Comey was involved in, which is well documented by the Inspector General report, deserve some sort of disciplinary action. But that's separate from whether the investigation of Russian interference with the U.S. election was legitimate. And, you know, to my way of looking at the facts, the problem here was that the FBI was putting so much focus on the investigation of Hillary Clinton and not enough focus when they learned that Russian operatives had been hacking Democratic National Committee computers a year before the election. In fact, we're very slow to get that investigation up and running.
Well, it does seem to be that the people that were involved in that, and Strzok was very much involved in that, you don't think their firing is in any way an attempt? I mean, I guess let me rephrase that. It would seem to me that Mueller already has the information he needs, right? This is firing these people seems more like vindictiveness than some kind of plot underway to diminish the FBI's ability to investigate Russia's interference.
As I said, the FBI's disciplinary process has been broken for decades. The Inspector General in 2002 and again in 2003 criticized this system. Then again in 2009 reviewed it and said it had gotten even worse. So this is a broken system, you know, and all you have to do is look at the Inspector General report and see the conduct of these high-level FBI officials to understand that there are serious problems within FBI management. Now, that does not necessarily say anything about the quality or necessity of the Russia investigation. And, you know, the fact that a special counsel is now heading that investigation, I think, clears up some of this issue. But what I hope comes out of this is the recognition that the FBI, despite 20 years of supposed reform, is in serious need of stronger oversight by Congress and public accountability.
But the structural problem that you mentioned, maybe it's a cultural problem, the divide between the agents in the field and the people in headquarters, I guess they're the SACs and the ASACs, is that right?
So the SACs and the ASACs are out in the field offices, but certainly the agent cadre has long expressed concerns about mismanagement within the FBI, and unfortunately that hasn't been a priority for reform. And the problems that we're seeing now, I think, are part of the the fact that we have given the FBI additional powers and less oversight. And when you have mismanagement that we had that was exposed after the 9/11 attacks, giving that agency more power and less oversight wasn't a good answer to the problem.
But in terms of the culture, is it what is the is it when I mentioned the SACs and the ASACs and friction between them and the people in the field, there's even more friction, right, between people in the field and people at headquarters. Is that the system? It sounds a little bit like the education system in this country, where they've loaded up the school system with lots of bureaucrats who are often at loggerheads with the teachers. I mean, maybe that's not an adequate analogy, but how
right, and I don't know enough about our education system to compare them, but basically what you have is an organization that was basically established by one man who ran the organization for 50 years, right, J. Edgar Hoover. And when he died, the structural problems that remained were never really addressed. And when I was an FBI agent in the 1990s, the FBI hired an outside company to come in and do a very thorough investigation of FBI management and propose reforms. And that report never saw the light of day. Again, in 2000, they asked Arthur Anderson to come in and do a review of, or actually in 2001, to do a review of the FBI's management systems. And again, that report was never published because what it's asking FBI managers to do is to reform a system that they benefit from. And so there's reluctance to adopt these reforms that would make the FBI a better organization. And, you know, unfortunately, the kind of credibility hit that they're taking, not just through the Clinton investigation, but now through the Russia-Trump investigation, I think is showing these deep structural issues within the FBI. And unfortunately, that's now being exploited by politicians to their own benefit rather than to make an effort to reform the FBI in a way that the public can have confidence that they're governed by the rule of law and do things for the right reasons.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Mike German, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte, is leading the kind of Tea Party charge to impeach Rod Rosenstein. And whether or not this firing of Peter Strzok will placate that or not, you don't think it will, I take it, and I certainly don't think
well,
it will.
Well, like I said, you know, these politicians haven't allowed their arguments to be altered by the facts.
Right.
So I'm not sure that they need additional facts in the first place. But number two is that there's very little Rod Rosenstein had to do with Peter Strzok's text messages. Right, and to the extent that the FBI deputy director chose to go above and beyond the recommendations of the professional staff regarding his discipline, augurs to the idea that they are being influenced by the Trump administration and perhaps these Freedom Caucus congressmen rather than the opposite.
Well, just in closing, though, it's a bit of an irony that Bobby Goodlatte, who's the son of the chairman, Bob Goodlatte, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee and one of the leading Tea Party congressmen out to impeach the Deputy Attorney General, Bobby Goodlatte says on Twitter, "I'm deeply embarrassed that Peter Strzok's career was ruined by my father's political grandstanding. Thank you for your service, sir. You are a patriot." So I guess that is some collateral damage there.
Right, but keep in mind that Peter Strzok had control over his text messaging.
Right.
And he made the choice to use a method of communication that was totally inappropriate for discussing
sure.
FBI investigations, much less more personal things.
Right.
Including his view of the subjects under investigation.
Well, Mike German, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael German, who's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office, and as a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, he served as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why Trump and the Republicans are not doing anything meaningful to protect the nation's electoral system the Russians attacked in 2016 and are poised to do so again in November.
I'm at home in the streets of Rome, or just hanging around Old Shanghai. Danger is my logo. Espionage and go-go, I'm just digging this American crime. Two deadly agents of a wicked persuasion tried to send me on a permanent vacation. I gave them the slip.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why U.S. Elections Remain Dangerously Vulnerable to Cyber Attacks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
Thank you so much.
And before we talk about the some of the stuff in your article, by the way, is extraordinary about what happened down in Georgia with John Ossoff in that special election to fill Tom Price's seat, which was heavily monitored at the time and obviously was a real test case for Trump. But I just wanted to follow on from our first guest about he just brought up his tremendous concern about, while we're talking about Omarosa and this dysfunctional White House and the follies that continue, serious things are happening, like the secret meeting that took place in Helsinki between Trump and Putin, of which there is no record. The other over this weekend in Russia, on their 60 Minutes program on state TV, there was a panel discussion about what Russia should do to retaliate against this latest round of American sanctions. And Vitaly Tyankov, the dean of the Moscow State University, he said that the Russian government should use whatever leverage it has over Trump to bend the president to its will. Let's turn this into a headache for Trump. If you want, talking about Trump, if you want us to support you in the elections coming up, do what we say. So they call him in Russia, Trump, our president. But the idea that it's possible that in that meeting in Helsinki, that what Trump and Putin talked about is how Putin can help him again, having helped him get elected in 2016, will he help him in 2020? Or did Trump ask for help because he's terrified of being impeached? He doesn't want to lose the House. It's not inconceivable to me that it's totally in Putin's interest to create chaos in this country. And can you imagine if the Democratic blue wave disappeared through a cyber attack across the country? It would make Florida 2000 look like a hiccup.
I think that's right, but I think the fundamental underlying problem of the fact that we don't have a record of what happened in Helsinki and what may or may not happen with the electoral system and voting machines is one and the same problem, which is we don't have a system of adequate accountability in either case. In the case of the president of the United States having a meeting with a foreign leader and not having anybody present in the room, that's on Trump. But as for the voting system, you know, it's been a theoretical possibility for a very long time that these machines could be hacked, whether that's by a foreign player or a domestic mischief maker, whether it's somebody on the inside of the electoral administration or whether it's a member of a political party with a vested interest in the outcome of a race. You know, the machines that were bought in the wake of the Florida meltdown in 2000, in large part were expensive, very poorly programmed, and in many cases unverifiable. And the machines I talk about in the piece in Georgia are those same machines. They were purchased in 2002, and they have not been updated. They've not been replaced. And, you know, it's deeply troubling now that they're still there, and people talk about them being outdated, and you wouldn't use a cell phone that was made in 2002. But the fact is that, you know, there were good machines that were available in 2002, and these were not them. So they're both outdated and wholly inadequate to the task. And, you know, what we desperately need in our electoral system and have always needed, and it long predates Trump, it long predates the concern about Russians hacking into this or that, is a system that is transparent and verifiable. And if something goes wrong for whatever reason, there is a backup. And we do not have it. You know, one of my sources said something to me in the course of my reporting that didn't make it into the piece. He said, you know, really the idea of the perfect voting machine is one that convinces the losers of an election that they've lost. We do not have those machines in this country. And, you know, particularly in certain key states like Georgia, also in South Carolina, in large parts of Pennsylvania, which is trying to change over, you know, there are a number of key places around the country where we do not have the best system we could have, which is essentially paper ballots that are then optically scanned by machines but are then auditable and verifiable in case of any question. On top of the machinery, we don't have the systems in place to audit any of the machines properly. In very few states, they do adequate auditing. And there are problems with the voter registration rolls, a number of things. And, you know, there has been money put forward by the Senate this March to try and shore up systems, you know, against the risk of an attack by Russia or anybody else. But the money hasn't come with any guidance from experts in the federal government or anywhere else. So it's been very unevenly applied. You know, there are some states who are very serious about this, California being among them, that have done a, you know, pretty decent job on the whole. There are other states that haven't either spent the money, like Georgia, or have spent it in ways that, you know, computer experts might take issue with. And we do not have the fundamental infrastructure for our democracy that we need to have. And that's a scandal. It's been a scandal that's gone on for a very long time.
But the Secretary of State in Georgia, Brian Kemp, is running for governor, as is Kris Kobach running for governor in Kansas. And he is, you know, neck and neck almost in the polls. So in both cases, you have right-wing ideologues who want to suppress the votes of opposition voters in charge of their own elections, and particularly in Kobach's case, where it's a, you know, what, 100 votes separating the two of them. That is pretty extraordinary in itself. So can we talk a little bit, you know, I wanted to give you, if you wouldn't mind, give us a quick version of what you reveal in your article about the John Ossoff race down there when Tom Price got fired. He quit his seat, and they had a special election, which was closely watched because of just kind of referendum on Trump. The Democrats spent an awful lot of money, Ossoff did, in this election, and he came within a hair of avoiding a runoff. But suddenly the numbers went down mysteriously. On the terms of the trend line. So what happened there with both Ossoff and, of course, this election systems, the Center for Election Systems in Kennesaw State University outside of Atlanta, who did the counting, and then they subsequently erased the entire record, and then they erased the backup record. So what happened?
So we... Yes, I mean, let me tell the story a little bit backwards in terms of where we are now and then back into what you're talking about. So where we are now is, as you point out, we have two hyper-partisan secretaries of state. And it's worth pointing out that not all secretaries of state are quite like Brian Kemp or Kris Kobach. So this is not necessarily a nationwide problem, but the fact that it's happening in two states is already too many. Brian Kemp's opponent the governor in Georgia is Stacey Abrams, who is a well-known voting rights advocate. And she founded a nonprofit a few years ago that was dedicated to registering as many new voters as possible in Georgia. So that, you know, the historical imbalance of power in Georgia that is now being offset somewhat by the demographic changes and political changes in that state can see some kind of justice come about at last. Brian Kemp has gone to war against Stacey Abrams on this very front for many years. He has done everything he can not to accept the new registrations that her group has managed to come up with. They've gone to court. They've tussled back and forth. So not only do you have a hyper-partisan who is in charge of the electoral process running for governor, which is bad enough, and you know potentially being in charge of overseeing the voting in his own race, but he's actually, you know, his opponent is somebody who he has a personal beef against on this very topic. And the reason why it's so worrying that Brian Kemp in particular is in charge of the electoral machinery is because of the way it's set up in Georgia, which is you have a centralized single system of Diebold touchscreen electronic screens, which have no paper backup and not verifiable. Ever since they've been installed in 2002, there have been questions pretty much every election as to whether the count was actually correct. People have analyzed, you know, polling data, broken down the state, county by county, and raised a lot of really troubling questions. You know, and what little documentary evidence there is not necessarily good documentary evidence. Just recently in a local election for which there's no national stakes whatsoever, there was one precinct which showed that 242% of the voters who showed up to sign in that day ended up voting. In other words, it's just wrong. And was this, you know, incompetence? Is this bad machinery? Is this malfeasance? We'll never know. On top of which, after the Ossoff race, as you point out, it was a two-round race, essentially, and John Ossoff was hoping to get 50% of the vote on the first round so that he wouldn't have to have a runoff against a split Republican field, you know, the winner of the split Republican field. On election night, at a certain point, he was over 50%. Then the machine started playing up. People saw things like the number of precincts reporting in Fulton County, which is the heart of Atlanta, going backwards at one point. Then the machines crashed completely down for more than an hour. And when they come back up, he's suddenly down to 48-point-something% and never recovers. And so it goes to a runoff, and he ends up losing the runoff to Karen Handel, who, by the way, is also a former Secretary of State of Georgia. Now, we don't know if him going down to 48% was the right result or the wrong result. You know, pre-election polling would suggest that he wasn't quite at 50%. So a lot of political analysts said, oh, well, this seems in line with our expectations. We're not going to ask too many questions. There were some people, however, who said, you know, the really troubling question is, you know, how will we ever know whether this is right or not? And we don't have an electoral system that enables us to know that for sure. We need to change the system. We need to press for paper ballots, which is something that Brian Kemp has vigorously opposed without really giving much reason. This electronic system is the security of the system and the software and all the rest of it was kept at Kennesaw State University outside Atlanta at a special center, which has been at the heart of the decision to go all electronic all the way back to 2002. And a computer security expert by the name of Logan Lamb managed to break into their system more or less inadvertently. He was just looking to see what was publicly available on their site. And suddenly he had downloaded the crown jewels of all their information, you know, social security numbers, voting histories for all 6.3 million voters in Georgia, passwords, administrative instructions on how to set up the system for election day, you know, things that should never, ever be in the public domain. He immediately alerted the center at Kennesaw State that he'd done this, assuming that they would fix it very quickly. 7 months later, this is just a few weeks before the Ossoff, the first round of that special election in Georgia's 6th district, a friend of his, just out of curiosity, sort of went to the same website to see what he could find and downloaded pretty much the same information. So it hadn't been fixed in over 7 months. The next thing that happened after the Ossoff race was that a bunch of voting rights activists got together and sued the state to demand an investigation, amongst other things. And as you point out, Kennesaw State then wiped their server clean, not once but twice. First, what they had on their main system, and then a backup. That was sufficiently embarrassing for Brian Kemp to then turn around and denounce Kennesaw State as reckless and unreliable. But what he then did was to take the election security part of the system in-house at the Secretary of State's office. So he now has everything under his control. The machines, the software, everything. And, you know, on top of which, whatever problems may have arisen in that huge security breach of having everything available to the public, including passwords, et cetera, for months on end, there is absolutely zero evidence that anything has been done to go through it, check for it, you know, put up safeguards, secure it, nothing. So we have a manifestly, you know, unreliable system that has a terrible history. We know there's been a major security breach, and the Secretary of State, in very belligerent form, who is known to be interested in suppressing the right of certain people to vote, has tried to stop voter registrations, et cetera, is running for governor and also has full control of the system. And, you know, this, without accusing him of anything, that's clearly a flagrant conflict of interest and shouldn't be tolerated. And a number of groups, including the Georgia Democratic Party, Common Cause, others have urged him to resign as Secretary of State so that he can not have that conflict. And he has so far refused pretty belligerently, which is his manner on every topic, apparently. So that's where we are in Georgia.
We've only got a minute left, so tell us where we are in terms of what I think is going to happen in 2018. I think Putin's going to really mess with the elections, and the blue wave could well disappear, and there'd be nothing but absolute disruption in this country, worse than anything by a factor of 1,000 that happened in Florida in 2000.
Right. Well, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen, but what we can say for sure is that we have systems that are vulnerable. The theoretical possibility of hacking into them exists. A number of computer scientists have done just that. They've taken machines and hacked into them pretty quickly and easily. There is a spotty, you know, unsatisfactory attempt to secure the system. Some states have more diverse systems than others. Some have more safeguards than others. There are certain states, including Georgia, that are of extreme concern because they're both politically sensitive and, from a security point of view, a disaster. And, you know, I think the other point that needs to be said, which I mentioned in the piece, is that there are two things going on. One is the risk of Russian hacking. But the other is the confidence that voters have in the system and the political consequences of that. And as one of my sources said, you know, the Russians really don't have to do an awful lot. They can just break into the system, let it be known they have, and just sit back and watch us destroy our own democracy as everybody screams at each other because nobody trusts the results.
Exactly. So that's exactly what I think is the game plan. And that was, you know, the game plan essentially in 2016. You know, it didn't matter whether Hillary or Trump won, as long as America gets divided and disrupted. I thank you for joining us, Andrew Gumbel.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, and The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections, and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why U.S. Elections Remain Dangerously Vulnerable to Cyber Attacks. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Marks. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.